This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable. All right, everybody, this is the How to Hunt Deer podcast. His name is Jason. My name is Dan. And crazy weekend, another crazy weekend coming up for me anyway. We had state baseball this weekend for my boy. Two nights worth of hotel rooms, going out to eat. Like, I'm getting old, so I'm just bitching about money all the time. Yeah. You know, this weekend it's three nights in a hotel room, and then, you know, obviously doing some, you know, going out to eat and not eating at home and spending money and all that stuff. So that's why I'm late today. You're going to be hearing throughout this episode, potentially, unless I can edit it out somehow, you're going to be hearing my air conditioner in the background. And it's just going to have to be that way. I forgot to turn my air conditioner on after my last episode, which was on Friday. And then it had all weekend to soak in the heat. And now I came up here and I just was like, oh my God. And now I'm going to run it. So hopefully it's okay where you can understand it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jason, did you have a good weekend?
You know, we did. And it's funny because it has to do with spending money and, you know, being an adult and everything. But so my wife and I had decided that we were going to get a Sam's Club membership. And okay. I had one 20 years ago, you know. It was a thing I used to do even when I was single. I'd stock up on stuff. And so she'd never been. And I thought, let's go. We don't have the kids. We just had the baby. So we went up Saturday and, dude, I didn't want to give you a number of what we spent, but I'll just be honest. Just like, so there's eight of us here, and my two are here half the week, right? And we spent $540, okay? And on an average week, we'll spend between $250 and $300 for groceries a week. So yep. What we spent at Sam's Club, though, we feel like we got some of the bigger bulk things that we wouldn't have to get at, you know, Walmart and whatever, right, to where maybe we won't have to make those trips. But I'll be honest with you, man, we did that shopping and whatever, and we had a great day. We really did. And then it was just fun. As fun as grocery shopping with your spouse could be, it was fun. And yeah. Sunday we had a introduction to football. Basically they did like a little signing thing where they signed their contract and stuff. It was kind of cool, but hot, dude. It was hot as heck. And then yesterday back into work, and then this whole week is going to be really hot. Next week looks like a little break, but I, you know, when you talk about like being busy and nights in hotel rooms and stuff, man, it just takes me to, you know, so she's got three girls of her own. So we deal with our exes, you know, with vacations and everything. And then like this week, my ex has my two kids on vacation. And then, you know, so we're constantly juggling them back and forth with sports and who's where and when and who's get, you know. So like last night, there was no tumbling for her youngest daughter, but there was track for her oldest daughter. So, you know, trying to keep all that in line, it is, I don't want to say stressful, but it is, you know. And it's a dynamic that, you know, we took on when we decided we were going to join families together. And it's fun though, you know, and it's going to be a short period. We did have so our newborn, she's got hip dysplasia in her left hip, and she had a doctor's appointment yesterday with the specialist. So they had to fit her for her brace, and she's going to have a brace on her, basically around her waist. It's kind of like a diaper, and it'll keep her hips like out like this. So your hips when you're born are supposed to be at like 60% within the ball and socket. Mm-hmm. And so her right one was at like 68 or 69%. Her left one is at, they did three images on an MRI, or ultrasound, I'm sorry. And it was 39%, 40%, and 42%. So she's pretty low on her left hip. So if it doesn't like come back in, you know, where it's supposed to be, then, you know, potentially surgeries or stuff like that would have to take place. But so she'll be getting this brace this week, and we just hope for the best with that. So,
yeah. Wow. That's a big weekend on a fun note and a serious note. And I don't know, man. I'm not complaining, but as a dad and all of the things I have to think about every single day, whether it is whether it's a serious issue or a scheduling issue or a sport, there's not very much time that I get to just shut my brain off. Like, I don't want to think about anything for like 10 minutes. I just want a reboot for like 10 minutes. And so this is the transition. I cannot wait for this hunting season to climb up in a tree stand and not have to think about a damn thing. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. I just want to shut my brain off for a couple hours. Like, I'm looking forward to that first solo hunt so much. It's going to be like a vacation for me, dude.
Well, and I think that's part of the drive, you know, as we develop from, you know, a beginning hunter, you know, it's all about killing deer and shooting a big one and all those things. But then as we evolve and we get older, it's not even about that at all. It's actually just about the peace and tranquility that, you know, sitting 20 feet up in a stand does, or even just sitting on a bucket, you know, it's like that peace of mind by yourself that, even if it's a half an hour, man, it's amazing. So yes, I'm with you. You know, we're less than three months away from it, and I can't wait.
Yeah. Yep. I'm getting fired up for that. So before we get into the topic of today, I got to send a shout out to Reveal Trail Cameras. All right. July 14th. I don't think I can say it yet. The new one that's coming out. There's a new, they're the cat's out of the bag. Already, I think there was actually a mistake made by a couple big box stores that they put that this new trail camera in their catalog that went out before the actual one was. Did you tell me that?
No, I heard this on your podcast last week with, who was it with?
Jeremy from Antler.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. It was with Jeremy. Yep.
Yeah. And so he was talking about this, and there was a catalog that came out that he looked at, and he's like, I didn't even think these were supposed to be out and available yet. And
I'm
so
looking at it right now.
Yeah. It came out. Anyway, the cat's out of the bag. There's a new camera coming. I'll talk more about it in a little bit, but, it's supposed to be pretty badass. On top of that, just like the ease of use of these trail cameras, I don't know what kind of guy you are. I don't necessarily care about big video modes and high quality images. Like, I'm using my trail camera as a kill tool, like I would use a saddle or a tree stand, right? I'm not looking for production value anything. I'm looking for, did this deer come through this pinch point? What direction was he coming from? What time of day was it? And I gather the information off of it. And then I use that along with my woodsmanship and and maybe other places that I've seen him from the stand. I go to other pinch points where he's huntable at, and I'm trying to make a move on him. But I'm not like, I don't care about anything else. Like, the pictures don't even have to be great. Anyway, what I'm getting at here is a Reveal trail camera is everything that you want, right? You want high quality images? They got it. You want videos? Yep. They got it. You want to use it like I use it? They do that too. Scan a QR code and it automatically sets the camera up. The app is badass as well. So go check out tacticam.com/cameras. They're going to have all the cameras there. I'm not sure when the new one is going to be getting released. I got to look into that. But outside of that, Reveal trail cameras, go check them out. Okay. I want you to talk to me about the biggest mistake you've ever made, or the biggest lesson learned on the hard way on a deer, on a buck you've been chasing?
Well, I mean, to say that there's one biggest mistake or 10, you know, I mean, it's hunting. So I've made so many of them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what a lot of guys, you know, misinterpret, you know, you're going to make mistakes. And the only way to shoot a big buck is to make mistakes and learn from them. And then you know, eventually you're never going to have a perfect slate with it. You know, you're always going to have something that, goes wrong, and it's not always you. It could be a neighbor, it could be a predator, you know, a coyote, a bobcat, anything.
Yeah.
But so I'm gonna go back to last year when we talked about like hunting small properties and stuff. You know, predominantly that's what I do, and I enjoy it. And I don't know if it's, you know, some guys may look at it like, oh, it's easy because, you know, small property you don't have to spend a lot of time with. You know, you can kind of dive in and you can say, well, this is a good piece, this is a bad piece, and so on and so forth. Yep. But there's also, with that, there's also, you don't have necessarily deer bedding on you. You don't necessarily have food. You're hoping and praying for a lot of travel to be consistent throughout the year. So what I'm going to say is, I think the biggest thing I've learned is hunting those small pieces with not having a lot of deer on or in those properties while I'm hunting them, I've become more apt to call, just because I can see and because, you know, I think they're not there and all those things. So a couple of the biggest bucks that I've ever encountered, came from small pieces. And one of them, I think we talked about last week or the week before. And he was a mainframe 10 and he was, you know, gosh, I don't know, 175, 180 inches, just thick, tall, and what you hope for. And I had rattled him off of a doe. He came into 60 yards on the neighbor's piece, and I'm sitting in a bottom. And so it's like two big, you know, hillsides come down to this bottom, and I'm sitting towards the edge of this bottom facing him directly, you know, south. He's south of me. He needs to cross the fence. And once he crosses the fence, you know, he's within 30, 35 yards. He hangs up. And so as I'm sitting in the stand, you know, I got a shoulder or a bicep grunt tube. And so yep. I turned gently and just gave him a one erp, you know, just to see if I could pull him down. And he started to come down and he got to probably 10 yards from that fence. I mean, he was at 40 yards at that point. He just needs to come across. But, you know, he couldn't see any other deer, and the wind probably shifted, or he caught a thermal in there, and lo and behold, he bolted out of there. So a lesson learned with that is, you know, that deer was way too close to actually call. Another one, very similar situation. I had called this giant 8-point in. I mean, 165, 170, just a huge framed 8-point. This was a couple of years ago, hunting a 50-acre piece. And this buck came in on a string. And as he's coming in, he's hitting licking branches. He's making scrapes and he's getting close. He comes south and then he needs to come back east to me. And as he's coming back east to me, you know, this being the biggest buck that probably the biggest frame buck that I've ever seen, he's sub 40 yards, and I finally decide that I'm gonna stand up. And as I'm getting ready to stand up in the stand, my elbow pops, and this deer just boom right away looks up at me in the tree. And by that time, he was probably 20 yards, right?
Your elbow popped so loud that he heard you?
Yep, because it was so crisp and so, you know, just dead. Yep. My right elbow popped. Is a baseball, you know, throwing. Yep. And it popped, and I'm like, oh my gosh, because I'd sat there for how long, and it got stiff, and I, you know, so my biggest lesson learned with all of it is that, lo and behold, he bolted out of there too. Because I could tell these stories, you know, about all these different bucks, but my common theme that I've seen is I've had these bucks come in, they hang up, they circle, they whatever, and I get antsy. You know, and like, why aren't you coming in? You know, what aren't you coming in for? And I'll try to either grunt at him, or that deer goes away, right? He goes away and he's 100, 200 yards away. And then you try to rattle at him. And, you know, so I think my biggest lessons learned are just knowing when or when not to call.
All right, guys, you know me, and I love eating wild game. but I don't eat wild game every single night. Every once in a while, I'll reach for a side of beef, and that's why I trust Omaha Steaks. Because Omaha Steaks are sent directly to my door, I can keep my freezer stocked without having to go to the grocery store. It's honestly like having a trusted butcher and gourmet food shop right at your house. Last week, I pulled out their pure ground ribeye burgers for a quick grill session. The flavor and marbling was unreal, rich, juicy, and miles ahead of any average grocery store meat. Try the Burger Perfection Flight at omahasteaks.com today. That's 20 premium steak burgers for just $79.99. Plus, get $35 off with promo code BEEF. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code BEEF, for $35 off at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. I'm glad you brought that up, all that, because I wrote a little list down while we were talking about the biggest mistakes that I've made, and 100% blind calling is now a no-no with me.
Mm-hmm.
Unless I start to get desperate, right? Yeah. Unless the week is coming to an end and I got to get home, or unless the, you know, all that stuff. I have been busted downwind or a deer coming in too hot, too fast when I'm rattling. And dude, just imagine a deer hearing you from 300 yards away. You can't see him. And he takes a big loop downwind and he's just like, okay, now I'm going to work my way in and I'm going to start. Okay. What's that smell? I don't know. I don't like that. I'm going to bolt. You don't even see him. Or right. He comes in on a line and he holds up just like what you were talking about, because he can't see anything that he thought just happened.
Right.
So the one thing that I've learned is I still take my rattling antlers with me. I still do a snort wheeze if I need to. I still do all those things. But that is why it is so important to have your tree stand in the natural movement of that terrain.
Right.
And a tree stand placement for natural movement is a different location than a tree stand placement for calling. Right.
Sure.
If I'm going to call, like I have a couple that are two in the same. I have a couple tree stands in river bottoms where in order for the deer to get downwind of me, they would have to, they'd have to be in a river. I'm not saying that's impossible, but I'm also telling you that a deer normally does not just hop in a river to try to get downwind. Right. They don't want to be in a river. They will be if they have to, but they're not going to try to get downwind of a noise by going into a river leg deep, belly deep, and trying to like maybe even swim. Anyway, when you have a backdrop like that, where it's an obstacle for the deer, that's when I might blind rattle,
yeah,
or blind call. But in a normal situation where a deer has the potential to come 365 or 360 degrees around you, I'm telling you, like, I'm not calling anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I'm waiting for natural deer movement to happen. And then that's when you have to be patient. So blind calling, man, if you're doing that, I would suggest, and this was so hard for me to do because I love rattling. Dude, I love rattling. And it's one of those things where for one season, just try to call 50% less and see what happens. Just see what happens. Let the deer movement come. Now, if you see a buck that you want to shoot on a field edge, just destroying a tree, making a scrape, doing all that stuff, call at him. Dude, if his body language is saying aggression, call at him. I'm not telling you to do it. I'm just saying don't wake up every morning and be like, I'm going to make these rattling antlers warm today, you know, and just destroy it. Wake up the timber. There's days where I feel like that might work, but dude, I don't do that anymore. I don't do that. I'm trying to catch them coming in naturally.
I think, you know, like I'm just sitting here looking at some of the mounts and so, trying to relive some of the hunts. And, you know, for me, calling, it's fun. I enjoy it. But a lot of times I'll pair my calling with a decoy setup, or I'll pair it with kind of like what you're saying, like where your tree stand placement is too, because, you know, even on some of these smaller pieces, there might be a knob, there might be a bench, or there might be a creek drainage or something. And as long as I know like where the anticipated deer movement is every day, day in and day out, yeah, they may circle, but there's a spot that you can call from or rattle from and see 360, you know, versus like I might be down in closer to a bottom or something, and I may not call in that scenario because I can't see anything on the outsides coming in. I don't know. I'm a little bit of a risk taker when it comes to that, because it's like I also look at it as there are not deer necessarily bedded on me. We might have one or two or three deer that are bedded in or around, you know, neighbor's property. So I'm kind of just going with like, if my movement's slow for the day, I may throw a couple calls out towards the end of the day, or, you know, within that first hour of daylight, I may try it, you know, and just see what happens. But I'm not going to blow it out every time too, because I have learned that calling that 50% less, like you're saying, there's more success in that. I really do believe that.
Yeah. Yep. I've been on public land before in my earlier years where I set up on a run and gun in a fair, on like this big ridge, and saw some good deer movement, but another guy was on like two ridges over and he was rattling every 30 minutes. And I was just watching the deer get downwind of him and then leave. And then get downwind to him and leave, and get all day. Even the does were hearing it. They would loop downwind, and like, you know what, to catch a buck in that, he has to be so fired up, almost to the point where he was on a doe and then lost her. He has to be in that mindset in order to come in on a frozen rope. Right. Most of the time it's a 3-year-old or younger
that responds
because a buck on a doe, more than likely, I'm not going to say it's impossible because nothing is impossible, but for the most part, bucks aren't just going to leave a hot doe to come in and say, hey, what's going on here?
No.
You know what I mean?
No. Oh, no. I mean, unless it's something to where he's about got her pinned down, or he's got her pinned down and he feels that there's a threat, I doubt he's getting up, you know, or moving. Yeah,
he's not leaving her. No. He's not leaving her.
No.
Okay.
Any other mistakes that you would like to throw in there?
Oh yeah, dude. I got 10 years of them.
Yeah.
I make mistakes every year, man.
Yeah.
Every single year. I don't know if it's a mistake per se, but it is a hard lesson, right? You know, obviously the first thing that you learn as a hunter is, one of the first things about deer biology is their nose and how powerful it is. Okay. So I've always been trying to put myself in a position to where I, how do I put this? I've been trying to put myself into a position where I'm trying to beat the nose, right? You don't want your scent, whether, like, I'm a huge fan of Ozonix, and I bring an Ozonix in the tree with me every hunt, and I soak my clothes in ozone before and after every hunt. So I believe in that. However, it's stupid to have your wind blowing right into a bedding area, right? Yeah, and trying absolutely. To rely on something like that 100%. It's not going to work. Anyway, thermals is what I'm getting at here. I learned the wind game. I learned how to cut the wind. But when you can understand thermals on top of that, if it's a cloudy day and your thermals are down, or if it's going to be a sunny morning where the second that sunlight hits you, that maybe it's a front came through the day before, it's one of those really cold, crisp mornings, cold front came through, and you can feel the thermals pulling down, but then that sun comes out and it just bloop.
Yeah.
It's just almost like a light switch. The air levels change, the air temperatures change. You got the sun air temperature, and you got the shadow air temperature, and you can almost see, like, I used to be able to, in a couple of these spots where I would drop milkweed, and it would almost just float on top of the cold air.
Yep.
Right. And it would be like this, and it was almost like a tide going out. And if that tide hadn't left yet and a deer came through, you would be surprised. Deer will come through these areas at the same time where they're getting the sunlight thermal, and they know, they can see all of that with their nose. It blows my mind how good they are at traversing terrain with, like, being able to read thermals with their nose. And then that's how they make their decisions on where to go and when to go there. Anyway, what I'm getting at is, once you can understand that, then your tree stands are going to move. I guarantee it.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, I feel like I'm too far away. No, you're just on the other side of it. You know what I mean? I have a couple tree stands, and this is it. I have a couple tree stands where they're awesome on a south wind, but I have them set up on a south wind only on sunny days. If it is a cloudy day, I'm not hunting it because my thermals will go down and they'll catch my thermals. But if it's a sunny day, my thermals go over their back with a south wind on a sunny day. My scent goes up and over the trail that I'm hunting, which a lot of people wouldn't do. Now, I had to learn that the hard way, because if I'm there on a cloudy day, thermals are down and they're bust. Every deer that comes through is busting me. The goal, though, is to be at full draw when they catch that scent. If they catch that scent,
right,
and then send an arrow. So,
yeah, I mean, I think just to piggyback off what you're saying, I think if you're just getting into hunting and you haven't dabbled with thermals or anything, you know, like you're saying, there's thermal pools, there's thermal hubs and everything, you'll figure it out as soon as you start doing milkweed, or I've heard guys do smoke bombs, you know, from their tree stand. But it, like the milkweed, if there's no wind, I mean, it will literally sit and float and swirl in a pool or in a thermal hub until the wind picks up or shifts in a direction, and then it will move it that way too, you know. But it, learning those things, it's time and stand, you know, and I think that's what it really comes down to with stand placement, is you're going to move that stand probably five times before you figure out which area you can hunt on which wind. But I like your point of the sun, you know, because a lot of times people don't, you know, put that into thought. You know, a lot of times they'll look at, I've heard guys say, you know, like high in the mornings and hunt low in the evenings, and that makes sense to some degree. But if you're not putting into the factor of, like, well, today's raining or today's overcast versus today's sunny, there is a big difference in the thermals.
And this just leads me to the statement, there is no such thing as a blanket statement.
Right.
Like, you should never call at a buck with a doe, or you should never blind rattle, or you should never hunt, you know, on a south wind with thermals, whatever the case is. It's impossible, right? You can't do that. I don't hunt your farms. You don't hunt mine. How can we talk about that stuff? So this is where, like, over the years, you just have to be extremely observant over and just go in. Now, you don't have to. You can go hunt field edges. Like, me and Jason here, we're psychopaths, right?
Yeah.
We think about this shit too much, probably.
Yeah.
It's like the other day I was driving down Interstate 80 from Des Moines back home yesterday, and I see like this. It's like I'm coming over this hill and I can see this, like, this big timber finger coming into a big bowl. And I'm thinking about how the air moves through there and where I would, how I would access this little crossing that I could see. And I was doing that every like 5 miles. My brain was just trying to shut off, stop thinking about baseball and my family for just a moment. And I was like, oh God, thermals, that looks good. I wonder what this is. And there's, like, normal people don't do that.
No, well, I was just going to say, like, I'm sitting here, I see this catalog and I'm looking at it and I'm envisioning myself in the stand, you know. But, like, one thing I do at work, specifically on a mower, is I'll judge yardage. You know, like I'll get to an end of a pass and I'll just stop and I'll look and I'm like, that pole's 32 yards, you know, and I do that just out of the practice of like, yeah. I'm not shooting my bow a lot right now. So it's like, I still need to be within it, but yeah. I'll do the same thing though, too. I mean, it could be at a job. It could be like a hardscape job, or it could be on a mower. Like you'll notice different things, different temperatures. You'll notice when the grass is wet, you know, and why it's wet versus, well, it didn't just rain, you know, certain ways that you start thinking about how you could access a certain property because, hey, it's early in the morning. It's not frosty, but the grass is wet, which also absorbs, you know, your scent too. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think that's a great thing. I mean, to be involved in it that much, I mean, that's how you become successful with it. You know, it's not just an obsession. Yeah. It's, you know, it's just part of it. I'm going to go with one here, mistake.
Yep.
This is something actually I think should be taken seriously instead of like just a lesson learned towards the deer. You know, when we're taught or when we self-teach ourselves to go out in the woods and whether we buy a ladder stand or whether we buy a hang-on or a saddle, I think the one thing that we need to keep in mind with it is, you know, obviously making sure everything's fastened tight, making sure all the straps are good and everything. But the biggest mistake that I had made for years as a beginner was I would get up there, I would get the stand in, and then I'd get out, you know, I'd trim lanes and whatever, and then I'd go to hunt it, right? And what I realized is, number one, the biggest failure I was having with that is I wasn't comfortable. I was leaning forward or the stand was leaning this way. And you're like, you compromise your hunt because of it. You know, your time
being the stand, uncomfortable, you mean?
100%. Okay. Yeah. And I think just taking the time to, first off, learn your equipment and like how adjustable it is or isn't, and then learning how to set it up in what type of tree and how high, you know, because there's a time when, you know, you're cutting branches, and you're like, oh, okay, I think I got it where I want, right? And then you set it up, you sit in it, you practice a couple shots here or there, and then you look around, yep, looks good. Climb down and you're on to the next one, right? That's how we were doing stands for years. We would go in and we'd knock out, you know, 10 to 20 stands in a weekend and we'd be good, right? We'd go to hunt some of those stands and then all of a sudden we're sitting like this, you know, and your back's cramping up or you're sitting forward and it's because like, well, you cut that one limb, but you got a knot in your back or something. You can't compromise that because or you can't take a shortcut because that will compromise your hunt.
Yep. Yep. Okay. I get it. Yeah, man. I'll tell you what, I can remember in my late 20s, dude, I was in some trees, in some sideways stands, just because I wanted to be in the right place. And I didn't care. I mean, I was hunting trees that were the size of baseball bats. I was like, I'd be leaning when the wind would blow. I'd be like, and especially in some of these smaller mobile run and gun type stands or in a saddle, maybe my first couple times getting used to saddle hunting and putting the platform and maybe it wasn't level or all those things. And I would sacrifice comfort for right location. But what I learned was you can have both. You just need to take a little bit of extra time to get in there and put the work into, you know, like putting the stand. Now, obviously the gear part of this is important because there are some tree stands that do only work in straight up and down trees.
Yep.
Or they only work in certain scenarios. And that's where like a saddle could potentially step in on a crooked tree or adjustable hang-ons like the Lone Wolf or the XOP or whatever. So yes. I really do think that these days I'm taking a little bit more time. I'm always having my run and gun set available, but I have my rut tree stands that are in the right spot and I am hunting those like they have to be comfortable because I'm putting in the most work in those. Actually, this March, knowing that I was going to be having, tree stand or knee surgery, I went in and I moved, I believe, 3 different tree stands into different locations. And I knew that I didn't know what the outcome of this knee surgery was, when I was going to get it, things like that. And, so I moved some tree stands and I made them in the right spot. And I took an extra, man, couple hours, maybe a couple hours to get in there. And, I don't know, like I got in there and took an extra hour per tree stand, trimming it out, making sure it was level. If I had to cut additional branches to move my tree stand on a different side of the, you know what I mean? Like, just made it comfortable.
Yeah.
So I could maybe stand up a little easier or sit down a little easier. Maybe there's not a knob in the back, things like all that kind of stuff.
I say that not only just for the comfort factor, but more so just for safety factors. I mean, cause yeah. You get in some of those stands and I've seen like bottoms kick out on guys, or, you know, something's not quite tight enough. And then the moment for the shot comes in and you stand up and it's you know, yep. The stand creaks or whatever. I think it's just a easy lesson learned by taking your time with it.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. Okay. Big mistake. Comfort and safety, obviously. That's a big one. Calling at deer, big mistakes. Learning. Okay, big mistakes. Straight line access routes. I used to be the guy who would straight line it right to the, from the truck to the tree stand. Especially if, so for example, if I was doing a run and gun, I would, let's say I started to learn to J hook into a spot to put myself, like, I don't want my scent while it's on the ground blowing into a bedding area. Now what I've learned is over the years is I'm okay with that as long as I'm a long ways away from it. Cause there's right. Certain times where, like, property borders, you can't go on that property and you want to hunt. So your scent has got to go somewhere.
Right.
And I'm not saying that there's deer everywhere, but deer are not just in one little huddle on a farm, right? They're all over the place. And so what I've learned, and this is kind of a theory that I've come up with, is if a deer smells me at 40 yards or 20 yards, he's spooked and he's gone, right? But if he smells me at 300 yards, he may catch it, but I don't think he's going to stand up and bolt, right? Especially if I'm just moving through, and then obviously my scent disappears as I'm moving through 300 yards away, then he's going to be like, okay, I smelled him. Now it's gone. I'm going to relax a little bit. And then I get up in the tree and now I have a Loctite, I don't stand location.
Right.
But I'm also taking a same access. Like, there's 2 different access routes. There's in and then there's out. I used to be the guy who would put all that energy and effort into the way in, but then straight line it out, walk through a field, spook all the deer on the way out back to the truck. Dude, that messes them up. I'm telling you, it messes up the natural flow. So I'm always trying to find that my access, let's say there's a really good tree stand. My access route on a morning hunt could be different than what it is on an afternoon hunt. You know what
sure,
I mean? And
sure.
So there's access routes for every time of day, for wind direction, for all that stuff. Now, there are times where you need to just get into the stand as quick as possible, but still, I don't know. That is one of the biggest things that I've attributed to my success over the years is access routes.
Yeah.
Hardcore access routes, man.
Yeah. I'm going to go with, I'll completely agree on that. And then I'm going to go with, I think gear. And when I say gear, I'm going to use that as like, be vague with it, but know what you have in your vehicle and know what you have in your pack and know what you have by the time you get to the stand. But with that said, you know, there's times that we take stuff for granted that, okay, well, I got this arrow set up. And I think this is a hard lesson learned too. And I'll just share this as my mistake. So a 100 grain broadhead does not shoot the same as a 100 grain field point. And no two broadheads really shoot the same. So right. If you're shooting an expandable 100 grain, you're shooting a fixed blade 100 grain, they're not going to fly the same. So one year I had been after one buck in particular, and a company I was shooting broadheads for, I was shooting some fixed blade broadheads, and one of them was a smaller diameter than the other size. Mm-hmm. I had bought two packs, one pack of the small, one pack of the big, and then I decided that I was going to start hunting with the small ones. So I had practiced right. and sighted my bow in for the small ones. By the time the moment of truth came to where this buck was actually able to be shot at, I didn't have a small broadhead on my arrow because I had already used the other three arrows on some does that I'd shot that year. And yeah. I had the big one on, and I went and shot, and I shot clean over his back. And it just hit me like, what in the world happened? You know, there's no way I missed this 24 yard shot. And yeah. so I came home and I'd ordered some more of the small broadheads and put them on, and I'm shooting darts again. So then I screw a big one on, and I'm shooting high. And lo and behold, it was user error. You know, I didn't take enough time to know my equipment.
Yeah. Yeah. Man. That's so important, is know your gear, practice with that gear. The details, even like knowing what's in your pack, you know, so I don't know, maybe it's just me. And I know a lot of other guys are the same way, but I don't just throw shit in my truck. It may look like it, you know, if you ask my wife, she'd be like, you're not organized, but I know what's in my pack. And so when I grab it, before and after the hunt, it's all in the same spot. And it has less to do with the gear and more to do with the organization in that particular, but what you're saying is know what heads are on, know how your bow shoots. Over the years, like, I've curated an arrow that I feel is going to have a lot of penetration. Like this year, for example, I'm dropping down to 65 pounds for right now. By the time the season starts, I may be back up to 70, but for right now, when I start shooting again, I'm at 65. That means that I've ordered lighter arrows this year, and I'm going to have to see how all of that performs.
Yeah.
Because what I don't want is my setup to cost me a deer.
No.
Right. And so I'm not going to sit here and shit on broadhead companies, but I've heard like at some of these guys, they shoot a deer and their arrow's too light, and then what that does is on these mechanicals, the energy loss is so great, even on the perfect shot, that the arrow isn't pushing the broadhead through the animal, and you're only getting one lung instead of two. And so I'm the kind of guy who, if 400, you know, if 400 grains or 380 grains is awesome, well, you know, what's going to be better is 500 grains. And I say that on whitetails 40 yards and in, right? Even though I'm not taking a 40 yard shot, because I don't put my tree stands where I can take 40 yard shots. What I'm getting at is know your gear. Basically, just know your gear, know what it's capable of. And the only thing that you can do with that is test it and mess around with it.
Yeah. I'm going to get a question. Since we're talking about mistakes, what is the biggest mistake you've made on a shot on a big mature buck?
Blacking out.
Okay.
But honestly, that's it, dude.
Yeah.
Blacking out.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with strategy. It had nothing to do with my gear. My gear was there. I took the right access routes. I had the deer at 22 yards broadside, 210 inches. Okay. What did I do? I blacked out. I straight up just was like, lost my shit. cost me the deer. I shot him high, hit him in the spine. 22 yards is a chip shot.
Yep.
And under the right circumstances, he wasn't even at a huge angle from me, right? It compared to where he was at versus where I was at, I don't know. I should have a 210 inch deer on my wall. Should, but I didn't because I lost my calm, right? I had never been there before. And why? This all kind of is a timeline because I thought it was more important to shoot big giant antler deer than it was to shoot deer.
Right.
Right. So my biggest mistake is that I didn't go through it's brown, it's down period when it came to bow hunting because, you know, I should have shot more does over my life and been comfortable just like drilling does and filled my freezers and my friend's freezers. That's how many deer I should have shot, but I didn't. I got swept into the big antler, big mature buck age class thing. Even when I was a kid, when I was in my 20s, I'd have trail camera pictures that I would show the landowner and he'd be like, I don't shoot that buck. There's way bigger bucks here than that farmer. You know, he's like, dude, I see him on my tractor all the time.
Yep.
You know, definitely don't shoot that buck. I'm like, okay. So I started passing 130 inch deer when I'd never even shot a 130 inch deer before. So what I'm getting at is stair step your way up. Killing more deer makes you better at killing deer. So when that 210 incher steps out, you're going to go into muscle memory. It doesn't help that I was chasing that buck for 5 years and then he shows up his biggest rack yet. And I wounded him. Next year, the neighbor shot him. So control yourself. Find a way to control yourself. For me, no sugar in the tree stand anymore because if you have a sugar rush and then that dumps and then you're tired, right? You may have some kind of effects there. Eating big meals before going into the tree stand. I don't eat breakfast. So it's just like I don't drink coffee. I'll put like a caffeine packet in my mouth. Before my afternoon hunts, I'm not binging on food, right? And then going in there and falling asleep and being tired. I'll eat, maybe rest, then go back into the timber, but I'm not stuffing my face. I am making sure that my body is able to handle. And so I got to be able to make sure that my body can handle that. And once I have it, once I locked that in, I'll be honest, man, killing deer became a little easier in the moment of truth.
I agree. I think the two things, I guess I'll go with on that. Don't shoot moving targets.
You 100%.
You get your animal to stop. If you can range find, you know, spots around
trees,
you so you know,
everything. Yep.
And if you can get a good range on the deer, the animal you're shooting at, 100% do it. Take the time and do it. The whole shot sequence is going to go so much better. But I'll also piggyback on what you're saying about the, if it's brown, it's down. The one thing about shooting a lot of deer and kind of working your way up the ladder is you start to size that picture up in your mind. And going back to what you were saying earlier with thinking about it all the time, can relive the size of that animal at certain yardage and what the vitals look like to you. So I think it's really crucial to take that into consideration.
Yep. And this is the perfect place to stop. We've run out of time on this episode. I do want to say, good luck, everybody. Now's the time. I'm going to start shooting. Well, not this week, but next week after state baseball's over, I'm going to start shooting my bow on a regular basis. I don't have any baseball practices anymore, which takes up 4 nights of my week. There's no more tournaments. It's just, I got just wrestling a couple nights a week now. And then from there, I don't know if my boys are going to be playing football or not. So we'll see, right?
Yeah.
We'll see. So outside of that, good luck, everybody. Listen to what Jason said. be safe when you're climbing up and down your tree stands, right? I know sometimes it's hard on a mobile setup to have a safety harness on the whole time. Make sure you're wearing your lineman's belt. Take that extra little second to make sure your sticks or your ladder is tied tight to the tree, because we don't want to lose you. Right. We want you here listening to this podcast and getting back home to your families. Outside of that, do me and Jason a huge favor. Go to iTunes or Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you download your podcast, and give us a 5-star review. Let us know that this information is helpful. Share it with your friends, and good luck and stay safe, everybody.